Hello and welcome to In Focus with Insight. My name is Pamela Hillig. I'm head of Insight Life Solutions. And today I'm joined by Stefanus van der Linde, who is funeral product owner at MMH. Welcome, Stefanus.
Thank you very much, Pam. It's great to be here.
Tell me about your role. What exactly does funeral product owner mean?
So as a funeral product owner, you are basically, it's more like, let's say we are a big team. And as a product owner, you are ultimately responsible for the profitability and the viability of the product. So that really means we engage across multidisciplinary teams, you know, from product development to pricing to engaging with IT systems, legal, communications with the channel to make sure that everything lands correctly. So we can't be everything at the end of the day, but we need to make sure that everything is connected for the ultimate benefit of our clients as well.
For those who don't know, what is the difference between funeral cover and life cover?
So funeral cover is typically a lot lower than life cover. So funeral cover is regulated. So it was back in 2018, it was regulated at 100,000 Rand per person per policy. And that would have now increased with inflation, probably sitting at about 100,000 currently. And there's no underwriting that takes place. And so I did actually think to myself, okay, but why do we operate it like that? And I think it's very much coming into how our medical schemes also works, right? Where we don't age rate in terms of for cover. And then what would happen is if we were to underwrite funeral policies, it would make that markedly more expensive because underwriting comes at a cost, and even more so for the low levels of cover that are required for funerals. And then also what would also happen is it would make for those that are older age, it would make it even more expensive, right? And then at the end of the day, we would sit with people who can't afford any cover at all.
Who is a typical funeral product client?
Sure. So I think when it comes to a funeral client, there's a lot of variation that comes to that. But for us, we're very much focused in the lower income market. We would have people that have only got salaries of 10,000 Rand per month. So what that really means is that we need to really stretch the value for them in terms of for them getting the bang for their buck.
And what is the current climate of, you know, the funeral market in South Africa?
Yeah, so for the current climate in terms of funeral, we are very much stressed in terms of the economic situation that we are in. Affordability is a big issue currently, and obviously that got exacerbated when COVID also hit. We see lots of clients struggling for that. And what that basically then leads to is it's difficult to grow in that type of climate. So we see competitors really, you know, trying to gain market share during this period.
Can you tell me, what does serving this market mean to you?
For me personally, I think when it comes to our clients, they only have a certain amount of disposable income, and you really want to stretch that as far as possible. And in the funeral industry, having a dignified funeral is very important in their culture. So instead of, let's say, saying, no, you need to use your money in a different way, you really want to partner with your client in terms of what is important for them. So you're not just saying, and be very paternalistic and saying, no, listen, you should be spending your money in this way or that way. But it's really about partnering and getting them the best value that money can buy.
So a funeral product, is that something, you know, that's exclusive to South Africa or African markets? And why is it such a big cultural mainstay in these markets?
Sure, Pam, that's a very good question. So I know definitely in the African culture, it is a big thing. I'm actually not sure if it's global as well. I could presume that there would be funeral markets out there as well, but I think it's very much entrenched in the culture of our continent.
And apart from the kind of macroeconomic challenges that that the clientele is facing, are there other challenges that both policyholders and insurers face in, you know, becoming adequately covered?
Yeah. When I think about that in terms of policyholder and shareholder, it's going to come a little bit back to the macroeconomic circumstances, but the biggest challenge that we face is affordability. And I think the reality is that if you don't have job security, right, that plays into your monthly income, right? So we would, for instance, have clients who at a point they can afford their premiums, but there comes a certain life event when they just simply can't afford it anymore. And that's why you would see many insurers, they offer a premium skip benefit or a premium holiday benefit for those specific times, right? When things are tough, when you can't afford it as such. And it's very much entrenched in the funeral industry. So you wouldn't see that in the life cover as an example. So affordability comes very much into play. And then the whole economic state as it is, job security and all that comes into it. But I think on top of that, you would also have, let's say, fraud, right? Also coming into it. Syndicates, they are literally out there to try and commit fraud and enrich themselves in the process.
Some very creative fraudsters out there.
Definitely. Unfortunately so. And I think that's a constant thing. And at the end of the day, that drives up the premium, right? So, I mean, if you're trying to solve for the funeral industry, if you can keep your premiums as low as possible, it means your affordability will be higher, right? So we very much, we call it NTUs, which is non-taken ups, where policies are sold, but the first premium never comes in. And early duration lapsation is also a big part of our industry, which you wouldn't see in other industries. And so things like that play into it at the end of the day. So anything that you can do to reduce the premium to help with the affordability, that's where it also comes in. And I think another key thing is also education, in terms of being education and awareness, I think almost as well. Because at the end of the day, insurance is a complex business, right? And conveying that to somebody, I mean, there's so many people that, you know, that haven't read through their policy contract, regardless of the market that they're in. And then you expect these clients to, you know, just know when to make use of a certain benefit to keep their policy alive or whatever the case might be. So, I mean, if you were able to solve for education and awareness of benefits, that would also go a long way to keeping policies alive for longer. Because, yeah, like lapsation, really, that has an influence on the premium that you ultimately have to price for. That's unfortunately the reality. But I think those key things in terms of affordability, if you can solve for that in terms of, I think that's where some of my passion also really comes in terms of how do you serve South Africa better, right? And it's a case where you can't control everything. And so what is within your control, and you really try to leverage off that one small step at a time. And if everybody can do that, at the end of the day, we can have a meaningful impact. But that really means we as a country essentially needs to stop blaming others for shortcomings and say, okay, listen, what around me can I actually change? What is my level of influence there? And then you just, you know, you make sure that you stay focused and remember what it is that you are working for. Do you want to make a difference in this country, or do you just want to, you know, blame others for the shortcomings?
Yeah, I can see how you're kind of relating the challenges you're seeing in this industry as almost a microcosm for South Africa's societal problems, and how, you know, you can apply the same principles to solving this problem to other, you know, issues as well. I also know that you are very interested in leadership and company culture and using those skills to solve, you know, societal problems. So can you tell me a bit about your leadership journey?
So my leadership journey, where do I start? I think, yes. So actually at school, I wanted to be, let's say, a leader, a prefect as such. I didn't get appointed. I was obviously, I was quite disappointed. And I remember my English teacher telling me, you do not need to be in a leadership position to be a leader. And I pretty much live that to this day. And I really believe in it. Because at the end of the day, if you are leading a team and you've got a lot of leaders in that team will have massive impact. So I think that's one of the key things. And I think also, with the journey from there on out, I mean, I've made a lot of mistakes in terms of trying things that didn't work. I was a team leader for a brief period when I was still in valuations. And from there, I actually moved over to a more specialist position. And I think during that time, so even though we're talking about leadership now, I actually distinctly made that decision to move into a specialist role, because I felt like I wasn't actually in a position where I was just being myself or whatever the case might be. So I made that move, even though people saw it maybe as like a demotion or a, you know, just a lateral move. But it worked out for me at the end because I could really focus on certain things and I could really excel in them. So I was just being myself in that role, and I really enjoyed that. And I think what also happened is, so there would have been people that, I mean, I've worked with brilliant leaders, but you would have people in leadership roles and managerial roles, and when they leave, you think like, oh, what's going to happen? How on earth are we going to replace this person? And then another person steps in and they do it in a completely different way, but it's also good. And that just shows you that different leaders have different leadership styles. One isn't necessarily better than the other, but it's about people living out who they are. And I'm a strong believer that if you are being true to yourself while also being challenged along the way and you're growing continuously, that's where you can have an impact. Because then you're not striving to be something that you are not. And you can really just freely live and freely go. And you're just being yourself. You can just be the best version of yourself at the end of the day. And then currently I'm actually busy with a middle leadership program with the company that I've enjoyed thoroughly. And I think what has been great in terms of the things that has been shared with us during this course is that a lot of the things that I've, let's say, believed internally is really shown, like, listen, these things, they do actually work. And it's sort of like a confirmation in terms of what your beliefs are. And I can see the little nuggets, if I can call it that, how when you are applying them, that it actually has an influence in terms of how the team is operating as such. And I think in any business, it's not a one-man show. And as long as one can appreciate that you play a part in this total design or whatever the case might be, that you appreciate the other people a lot more.
So what are some of the practical leadership techniques you've implemented that you've been able to see a benefit for the client?
Okay, so that's always something that comes to the fore in terms of how does it actually eventually impact the client. And I think sometimes we are quite far removed from the client, but the thing is that we need to understand the things that we do, what impact that has on the eventual client. Even though we are far removed from the client, the things that we do does have an impact. So whether it be, you know, making sure that you are collaborating with all the relevant people before sending out communication. So for instance, me as an actuary, I'm not the best communicator at all, but there are people that really understand the client journey. And a small thing here or a small thing there can completely change how that message is interpreted. So if you are more open and not just trying to say, okay, listen, no, I'm in control of this thing, I'm just gonna do it, but you're taking that step and say, listen, I'm not the expert in this thing. Let me just check in, and we have them come into play and help make the decision in terms of how we are communicating. And then it's all those little small things in terms of how you are engaging, being open and vulnerable to say, yeah, I'm not the expert here. I need your help in this. And to say, like, I can't do everything, because from what I've seen, nobody likes to know it all.
Well, I think, you know, it's not to be taken for granted that a leader needs to cultivate that environment of psychological safety where people feel like they can admit when they're not the expert in something. And I think that's the way to get the best out of people, when they feel comfortable to be themselves, recognize their own strengths, and also, you know, recognize where other people may be better at things.
No, definitely. And I think if you're creating that environment where people feel free to speak up, because I think that's what can happen quite easily, where those with the strongest personalities, they mm-hmm. come to the fore most. Whereas actually somebody has a good idea, but out of fear or out of being told, like, no, it's not a good idea, or no, it's a bad idea, or whatever. Because that's the process. When you look at innovation, right? I mean, it's failure upon failure upon failure that you need to work through. And it's also about, the answer is not the answer. The process is the answer, and it's how you go about actually getting there. That's almost more important. And it's actually, when you look at it, it's like the same with maths, right? Because if you just had to, like, answer one question and it's like, okay, I'll just take the answer and I put it down there. If you get a new question, you can't apply that same answer.
Never thought of it that way. Actuarial training comes in handy now and then.
Yeah.
So your team is obviously all you know, very motivated and, you know, has found their why. Do you think it's, you know, which comes first? Is it, does one first need to see success and actually see how, for example, the clients are benefited from the work you're doing? Or does the motivation need to come from the inside in order to do the things that benefit the client?
So I think it could be a little bit of both. I mean, so there's no right or wrong in this instance, but I think seeing the success definitely motivates you to keep going, because there's nothing worse than, let's say you're having your, you understand your why, you're doing all the effort, but there's nothing coming from it. That's not a sustainable model from that perspective. And that's why it's important to be executing on the right thing. And it's really about understanding what is it that you're trying to solve for. So there's the concept about the five whys, where you need to ask why five times, and then you can typically get to the root cause of the problem. And sometimes if you get to the first, second, or third why and solve for that, then you don't really see an impact because you didn't really understand the problem from the beginning. And I think it's important to celebrate the small successes as well as the big ones, and also celebrate the failures as well, because success didn't just happen one day. You had to make some mistakes along the way, and a fear of failure can be a massive hurdle to success. If you're that scared of doing the wrong thing, you actually end up doing nothing. And in the funeral industry, because there's a lot of high volumes, if you realize there's an opportunity or something went wrong, if you don't act on it quickly, it has a very big impact. And so that delay in your execution can become quite a problem.
So as you say, that's where the trust becomes important, that you need to trust your team. Is there something about diversity and thinking that can also help spot these issues, or, you know, be early warning systems to pick up things that other people may not have picked up? Is that something you've seen in your team?
Oh, definitely. No, I always welcome diversity of thought and different. So if you have a process in place, you can't just expect one, let's say, control to be able to catch what's going on. You need to have various things across the process, and you can't be dependent just on that one thing. And it's people coming from different viewpoints, different perspectives. And I've seen that very specifically when I moved across from valuations into the product space, where I would look at financials in one way, and then when I tried to present it to our sales force or our channel, then I realized that looking at it from a completely different perspective, because their client is completely different to what we would have been used to, let's say from a valuation perspective. And I think that's where sometimes, I don't know if sometimes people miss one another, but you would have different perspectives. The one isn't right and the other one is wrong. They're different. They're focusing on different things. And it's, I think that's why I really enjoy actuarial science, because it's when you try to have everything basically connect and how it relates to one another and understanding that whole picture. I think something like that excites me. So that's like the nerd in me, like trying to connect all the dots, even though it's not necessarily in my job description to connect all of the dots. I think that's from an understanding perspective what I really enjoy. And I think especially since my time in product, I've engaged with so many different people and so many different professionals, and it's really been just different, right, from what I was used to, and just different perspectives. And it really opens up your mind. And it's like you might have had an assumption about how something works, but in reality, it's different. And I think when it comes to solving for the problems that we have in our industry, we can't have the hat on to say, listen, we're going to solve this problem from head office. You can't have that. You need the different insights from the different people, because at the end of the day, it's a complex world that we are living in and what we are trying to solve for.
What's your why?
My why, in terms of work?
Yes.
So,
well, are they different? Do you have a different why, you know, in your personal life versus work? Or do they kind of dovetail to the same thing?
So, good question. And the why is going to be different for everyone. And I think for me, it's about using the talents that we have obtained and making the best use of them, and really having an impact on the people around you, and then hoping that flows over to others as well. So I think so. For instance, for me as a father, I know I want to have a big impact on my children's life. And then from a work perspective is to say, how can the little good that I do make it a little bit easier for the client at the end of the day?
Can you tell me what are some of the trends that you foresee in, you know, funeral business in the near future?
So I think what we have definitely seen over the last while in terms of trends is there's been a big technological trend where people are going more digital, more paperless as such. Adoption was definitely, in, let's say, a challenge around that. But I think COVID definitely sped up that process where we saw how it was made difficult to sell a policy during that time. So adoption was greatly improved because of that. What we also see is banks coming more into the fray when it comes to the funeral industry. So there's our challenge in terms of how to deal with that. And then what we also see currently happening is that people aren't necessarily trying to build capabilities in-house. They rather partner with other partners in that to basically change the way that they're going about bringing the product to the eventual client. Accessibility is always a big thing in terms of how do you gain access to that client and how do you contact them and how do you stay in touch with them so that when you are contacting them, they actually respond and engage in the process.
I know it's a buzzword, but have you seen the impact of AI affecting the business yet, or do you foresee it kind of making your clients' lives easier?
I think it's the value that you extract from it, right? So it can be from a servicing perspective, definitely, where you've got that automation running out and you've basically got less errors maybe coming out of it, but not necessarily across the board. So there's still a trust component when it comes to funeral business. We see the younger clientele being more open to, let's say, the digital and the AI capabilities that are out there. But I think it's going about it smartly, because sometimes what happens is there's a new tool on the market and then you try and apply that tool to the problem. But the problem is you don't understand the problem that you're trying to solve for as well. And that's sometimes why things fail as well. So yeah, it's still to be seen, but there's definitely value. It's just about how to go about doing it.
And last question. What message would you give to actuaries, young or old, who are interested in becoming leaders but perhaps don't know how?
So a very good question, Pam. Thanks for that. I think to become a leader, it's don't worry about the one big thing that you do or don't do. Just make continuous steps along the way. Surround yourself with people who also believe in you or who encourage you along the journey, because it's not a journey that you do by just, you know, going sitting in a corner and now I'm going to become a great leader. You learn a lot from engaging with different people. Be vulnerable, be open. It's the best way to learn. Don't be afraid to ask questions and stand by that. You know, and then also don't try to change everything at once. Focus on one thing, because I think sometimes that's where I can be a bit of a dreamer in terms of trying to change the world or whatever the case might be. But the reality is you need to start somewhere. You need to do something. Do something so that you can see change happening. And then you go from there. That's basically like a little lighthouse event that you can showcase. Okay, listen, I've done something that's actually had an impact. Now I move on to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And it becomes contagious. So I think being a leader means you need to live out those values. Because you would see, if you want to change something, you're not going to get it right the first time, the second time, the third time, even if it's the same message that you're doing basically over and over and over again. You need to be persistent about it, but you also need to know that you're heading in the right direction as well. So ask people, what are your blind spots? Because there's nothing worse than going in a direction and you are clearly wrong, but nobody is telling you, like, listen, maybe just try something a little bit different here.
Thank you so much, Stefanos. If our followers, our audience, do want to stay in touch and follow your journey, where can they get hold of you?
So it's actually a funny thing. I currently don't have a LinkedIn account, but I think it's part of my journey as well in terms of really trying to focus on where you are trying to have your impact. You know, it's all that thing about like almost like charity starts at home. You can't reach others if you can't reach the people right next around you. So, but I think it is perhaps time that I put myself on LinkedIn. So we'll see how that goes. But yeah, so if I have to keep on being true to myself, make myself vulnerable, I'm going to put myself out there on social media, basically see how it goes.
You heard it here first.
Very true. So yeah, we'll see how it goes. But currently, I'm very excited about where things are heading, also for our country, even in our current circumstances. So I think something that I'm drawing a lot of inspiration from as well was the whole Chasing the Sun series. It's funny talking about rugby on an actuarial podcast, but I think what they really were able to do is they all understood their why very clearly. They were a group of team players. There were no dictatorials in there. They were coming up with ideas together, collaborating together. They were able to, you know, not put themselves first, but put the team first, and really to inspire people and to make an influence in the country. When Rassie at the end said, you know, when people back home are saying things, bad things, stand up for your country. And I think that really inspired me in terms of we need to believe that we can make a difference. And we need to start small, and then success will come from that, and then you can inspire.
Perfect note to end on. Thank you so much, Stefanos.
Thanks, Pam.